Hello and welcome to the Bikecast. Today I was going to keep elaborating on the idea that it is a trap, a pitfall, a danger to use legislation, the police power of the state, to solve your problems or address issues that you care about as an individual or a community. So in a previous podcast or a previous set of material that I imagine will get turned into a podcast, I talked about a sort of a fictionalized version of prohibition in the temperance movement. As I recall, I talked about sort of two different patterns, one in which you find yourself funded by a state structure instead of something more community-oriented, and then the state comes upon hard times and is unable to continue funding, and your program is cut and vanishes because the structure that had been in place, the nascent grassroots structure that had wanted the thing to come into existence, has ceased to exist in the intervening period of time. And then in the other case of a binary decision, essentially, this is allowed, this is not allowed, and rather than finding ways to subvert or get around the authority of the state, find other ways to address the problem caused by the legal decision being the way that it is. Time and effort and energy is spent lobbying the state for a change of the binary switch, and then the change comes, all of the grassroots infrastructure that is in place to support and protect and help and what have you, at the community level, is all disbanded and all the individuals go their various ways. And then in 10 or 20 or 30 years, when people of the opposing viewpoint take power, they switch the law back and the full weight of the original oppression returns. But this time, the mechanisms that made it bearable or were allowed in people to subvert the unjust law or the silly rule are all gone. Now, I don't think this is intentional. I think this is just another aspect of a survivable institution, that survivable institution being the state or patriarchy or however you want to term the use of violence to organize society. So here in Austin recently, there's been sort of an explosion of Silverstream trailers selling food and vans selling food and modified school buses selling food and basically a whole lot of mobile vendors. So I was reading an article, I think it's from last year, so it's not that recent of an issue, but it doesn't really matter. For the point that it makes, so there are three levels of vendor in this article, roughly. There are licensed independent vendors, there are gray market, unlicensed or questionably licensed vendors, or vendors with licenses that aren't, quote unquote, following the rules. And then on the other side of the independent vendor, who is the law-abiding independent vendor, is the mega vendor, I guess, who has 50 or 60 or 100 trucks or something, and he actually rents the trucks out to people. So the long and the short of it is the big vendor, the mega vendor, is trying to increase the restrictiveness of code enforcement or increase code enforcement or add additional laws to the code and have those enforced on the independent vendors and the unlicensed vendors. And the independent licensed vendors don't want the mega vendors' code to be enforced, but they do want to enforce existing codes on unlicensed vendors and sort of the shoddy vendors running about, not following the proper procedures. And the main argument in both cases is that the competition is unfair if one per set of people is following the rules and another set is not following the rules and is able, therefore, to provide their products and services at a lower price. Two things are interesting about this. One of them is a tangent, maybe I'll pick up another time, which is that what we see here is the classic and yet denied slash unknown dynamic of government regulation, which is that regulation does not come from consumer watchdog groups trying to find ways to protect consumers. Sometimes those groups are enlisted to support regulation somewhere during the political process, but regulation comes from business owners, typically at the higher end of things, the more established business owner, because they're the ones with money to spend on such things, attempting to legislate away as competition by creating regulations that only somebody in a financially strong position can afford to follow or comply with. And this is a classic way of driving out small businesses that are competing with you being a large business owner. A guy named Gabriel Kolko, who I believe is still alive, professoring somewhere, wrote a book called The Triumph of Conservatism, in which he details this pattern. Specifically, he talks about the progressive era, 1880s to 1940 or something around in there, where the school book history story is that the capitalists and the forces of conservatism were getting so big and powerful that the federal government had to step in with antitrust legislation and various regulations and labor laws and so forth to limit their evil doing. And what Colco finds in a very deeply researched tome, that again I'll link to in the show notes, is that in fact all of the villains from that era essentially set up the regulatory system in such a way that certain market sectors, for example, energy, oil, and commodities, steel, a lot of the elements of production, were irrevocably shifted into the orbit of huge business because the regulatory apparatus that was set up made it impossible for anyone to compete with the established existing companies. But that's sort of a tangent. The main point I want to make with regard to the food carts is that at some point in time, the concern was raised that, hey, there are these people in their houses making food, driving it over to work sites and selling it there. To jump out of the narrative for a second, I'm guessing these people probably are restaurant owners in the area. So we already see that even the origins of this, in my granted fictionalized version, the origins probably come from established business owners attempting to limit the freedom of action of their competitors. But let's go back now into the narrative where these people are making food in their homes, driving out to work sites, selling the food out of the back of their trucks, without anyone checking to see what the contents of the food are, how the food's kept, how it's prepared, the safety of the kitchen. There are, even removing the malevolent motivations for regulation, there are concerns. Nobody wants to eat unhealthy food. No one wants to die from eating a breakfast taco. So there's a simple enough fix, and people like simple fixes, which is to have officials of the city visit these places, look down a checklist of dangers that experts have agreed are dangerous, find the violations, and then force the owners of the restaurants to pay for the violations. Again, in another tangent, if they don't pay, of course, the restaurant is shut down and or seized, or the violator is taken to prison. So not a fine to be trifled with. And at the time it was put into place, I'm sure it probably made sense. There was probably a fairly small list of things about no rats in the kitchen, no food sitting out for days on top of the counter, etc., etc. But because that path was chosen, we now find ourselves, however many years or decades after the initial move in that direction, the initial course was decided, with increasingly onerous, is the word they like to use, regulations that are limiting the availability of food to the consumer. And not because there is an increasing amount of illness, an increasing number of complaints. And it's none of those things. It's all due to competitors inside of a particular market niche attempting to make what their competition is doing illegal, or attempting to enforce laws that exist that will put their competition out of business, or hamper them severely at least. So it's just an unintended consequence. Now, you can imagine, as I sort of ran through with the temperance movement people, you can imagine if it weren't a piece of legislation being pushed through by existing businesses and sort of moneyed interests, you could imagine someone saying, well, before we decide what path to tread down, let's at least consider the nonviolent path. We understand code enforcement, we understand the police at all. We've got a good feel for how that works, and we can engage them if need be, but before we do that, can we come up with anything that might be an alternative to using violence to solve this problem of the possibility of taco-borne illnesses? And of course, anybody with any imagination can think of a million different ways to lower the risk that you're going to get sick from eating breakfast tacos. It's really, in a sense, not that challenging of a task. I'm pretty lazy, and I've got a pretty strong stomach, so I would probably rely just on word of mouth. Where is good food? Where is bad food? Brainstorming about alternatives is not the point at the moment. Time will come again and again where future directions are chosen, and things that are currently outside of the control of the warmongering state, or on the city level, the brutish, thuggish state, at least, not as much warmongering in Austin. New questions will arise that need to be decided, and the question will be, do we as concerned individuals find a nonviolent way to solve this problem, or do we run to the state, to the city, to the police, and involve them, and consequently involve them for all of time in making that decision? I've got one more example, but I'll leave that for next time. So if you have any interest in looking at the show notes or would like to leave a question or comment, the website is jad-davis.com. I hope to see you stop by. Thanks for listening.